You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 545. Absorb what is useful, discard what is not, add what is uniquely your own. Bruce Lee.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Indie Film Hustle Pro, our private and growing community for filmmakers and screenwriters. It was created for film creatives like you to meet, network, and support each other, learn from film industry experts, and to get the answers to your burning questions and more. The journey in this business is rough. There is no guarantee to success, but your chances of reaching your goals dramatically improve when you find others who are on the same journey as you and you work together towards a common goal. That is why I put together IFH Pro. Inside, you'll get professional networking, private and safe spaces to discuss the film business, access to advanced tools and education, up-to-date education, exclusive content not available publicly, access to IFH Pro workshops, webinars, special guests, and so, so much more. If you want to check it out, head over to indiefilmhustle.com/pro. Today's show is also sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Well, guys, you are in for a treat. If you are a fan of 80s films, action, like exploitation films, this is the episode for you. Today, we are talking to the writer-director, Sam Furstenberg. Now, Sam was at the very beginning of the rise of Canon Film, the legendary movie studio that brought us amazing films in the 80s, including the ninja movie. You know, the movies about ninjas and things were all basically brought in by Canon Films. And Sam was responsible for directing one of their biggest ninja movies ever, which was American Ninja. Now, for anybody living in the 80s or early 90s, American Ninja, Michael Dudikoff, was just the thing. It was insane to watch. He also directed Revenge of the Ninja, Ninja 3, and brought us one of the greatest titles in movie history, Break Into the Electric Boogaloo, the sequel to the breakout breakdancing hit, Breakin', which, again, if you were around in the 80s, you knew how big of a deal that was. Now, Sam and I talked all about the beginnings of his career, how he got involved with Canon Films and the producers there, and so, so much more. So this is just a fun, fun, fun episode. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Sam Furstenberg. I'd like to welcome to the show Sam Furstenberg. How are you doing, Sam?
Excellent, thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
Thank you so much for reaching out to me. I was excited when I got your email. I'm like, oh my God, I gotta talk to Sam. I gotta get into the stories. I'm sure you have one or two stories about your time at Canon and all of your directing and filmmaking career throughout the 80s, 90s, and even in the 70s as well. But specifically, we're going to focus on the 80s and 90s and a lot of the cool stuff you did back in those days. But before we get started, how did you get started in this business?
I was one of those kids who love movies, love cinema. And actually, one of the, you know, there's always this one kid who goes and see the movies and comes back to the neighborhood and tells the movie to the other kids. So this was me. So the answer, I don't know. The love to cinema is, I don't know where it comes from. The love of storytelling. Mm-hmm. But I grew up in Israel. I'm from Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And I had no knowledge. We didn't have television even then when I was a kid. In the 50s, and when I finished high school and the mandatory service in the military in Israel, so by the time I finished at 21, I decided I'm going to Hollywood to study film, to learn how to make movies. So that's basically it. I traveled from Israel to Los Angeles and enrolled in film school, and I started to learn how you make film. Luckily, I met a famous Israeli producer, Menachem Golan, that in Israel he was very famous, and I met him here in Los Angeles in Hollywood, and I started working in with him, with other movies, all kind of odd jobs, assistant, helper, grip, electric, or anything in the beginning. So that's how I started into the business of movie making.
So you started with him and started just doing any little odd jobs. And he was already – was he – for everyone listening, he started – he was one of the co-founders of the legendary Canon Films.
Correct. But the but that time was still – 1972, 1973, there was no connection between him and Canon at the time.
Okay.
He was producing movies in Israel together with his cousin, Yoram Globus, and they came here to Hollywood. They sold a movie, Casablanca, and they created a small company. The name of the company was Ameri Euro Picture, and they produced a movie. He directed, they produced a movie with Tony Curtis. Was called Lepke, a gangster movie. Mm-hmm. So in the 70s, you know, they had a company in Israel, Noah Film, and they had this little company, Ameri Euro Picture, that produced Lepke, then produced another movie with Robert Shaw, Diamonds, and a few little movies. They purchased Canon. They did not establish Canon. Canon was at a company in New York, a small distribution and sales company of movies in New York. And they purchased the company, I believe, in the beginning of the 80s, 1979, 1980. They purchased, they took over this company, Canon, and then they took it all, and they took it and made it into a huge company.
Right. But what was Canon doing prior to them getting it? I mean, they were just a normal small little distributor, right? They weren't doing genre stuff.
Correct. They were. Producers and distributors, they produced some movies. The base was in Israel, in Tel Aviv. This was the base. Mm-hmm. And they produced a lot of Israeli movies. They made a lot of local Hebrew-speaking movies in conjunction with making this movie, let's say, that I mentioned, Lepke, Diamonds with Robert Shaw. I was assistant director in the movie Diamond. They produced a movie which is called The Passover Plot. So a mixture of Israeli movies and some kind of international movies, English-speaking international movies, but they were very good at sales. Mm-hmm. They used to go every year to Cannes Film Festival and to all the other film festival and film market and sell those movies that they produced. And they became very knowledgeable and with this process of selling movie internationally up to this point. They always had a dream. Both of them always had a dream to go to Hollywood one day to make it in Hollywood. And eventually they did. So the opportunity was, they produced in Israel kind of successful movie, Operation Thunderbolt, about the Entebbe operation. Mm-hmm. And they sold it to one of the major studios here. And I guess, my guess is with the money of the sale, they bought this company, Canon. They also had another hit. It was Lemon PepsiCo. It was a Hebrew-speaking movie that produced by was directed by Boaz Davidson, and also a movie that made a lot of money. So I guess that with the profits of both of those movies, they were able to buy or to take over Canon.
So how did they start? Since you were basically there working with them. How did they make the decision to start going into genre? Because everything you're telling me right now is none of it's really genre. Yeah, maybe a gangster movie here and there, but not genre as we knew it.
Correct. When they produced movies in Israel, they were mainly local comedy that catered to the local audience. Mm-hmm. Very much like movies in Turkey or in Greece or in Egypt, those kind of local comedies that deal with local subjects. And then they kind of always flirted with action a little bit. As I say, Operation Thunderbolt was a big action movie, actually, military action. But they had the espionage movies. Yeah. They flirted with action. When they came to, when they took over Canon, it was in the 80s, 1980s, 1981. What was very popular at the time here in Hollywood for the low-budget independent is to make low-budget horror pictures. Mm-hmm. This was the standard. There were many, many of them done. Very low-budget, you know. Not much has changed.
Yeah, not much has changed.
by the Sorcerer, but other movies, by The Exorcist. Influenced by the movie The Exorcist, but others, you know, there were so many. And Canon, those two partners and cousins, Menachem Golan and Yoram Globus, they decided to go this route of low budget because it's really cheap to make horror pictures. But they were not very successful in terms of it was not part of their culture. They didn't grow up in America. The horror picture is a very American genre. It's a very specific American genre, which is not definitely not at that time. Was made in other countries around the world, mm-hmm. but it didn't really catch because they didn't understand the essence. They didn't grow up with a horror picture, so they decided at some point to switch to action. And the first action movie they produced was called Enter the Ninja.
So where did the ninja come from? Because essentially they popularized the concept of a ninja in America. I mean, I dressed as a ninja. I went to ninja school. I had throwing knives. I mean, I did nunchucks. I mean, yeah, there's Bruce Lee with but the ninja was, they brought it to America.
Definitely. So next to the horror picture, there was another genre floating around. Of course, you had from Hong Kong, the martial art movie, the Chinese Hong Kong martial art movies, which we used to call them karate movies or kung fu movies. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But there was a beginning, Chuck Norris, Octagon, and then Enter the Dragon with Bruce Lee. So there was this other genre, martial art, going parallel to the to the horror pictures, but not as big, you know. Mm-hmm. And there were a few. And one day, Menachem Golan used to hear ideas. People came to him with scripts and ideas. And the story is, the legend is, I did not witness it, that one day Mike Stone walked into the office, and Mike Stone was one of the champions, as well as Chuck Norris and Tadashi and Bruce Lee. And he pitched to Menachem Golan this idea to make a movie about ninja. And now ninja was a, as you say, was a novel idea, was a different idea because we all knew about samurai movies. The enthusiasts have seen Akira Kurosawa, Seven Samurai, Yojimbo, and we all knew about the Americans' martial art movie. Enter the Dragon was a big one, But ninja, nobody ever heard. It's a specific, you know, subgenre of the in Japan, in the Japanese mythology of martial art, in the Japanese culture. And nobody ever thought. Later on, I found out that here and there in Hong Kong movies, there was some appearance of
ninjas. A ninja here.
Always as bad guys.
Always. Bad guys. Sure.
Here and there, very, very few, very sparse. But here, Mike Stone pitched to Menahem Golan an idea. He probably had a storyline. I wasn't there. And Menahem Golan loved it. And he said, okay, that's, I understand. Actually, for the international market, that's something that I understand. And they produced, and they went to the, they did it, filming it in the Philippines. They filmed it in the Philippines. And they did it. And came back editing, and they sold it well, pretty well. Much they sold it in a much better way than they sold that they did with the horse.
Yeah, right.
So I guess, you know, I'm trying to play to play to be in his brain. So I guess they decided, okay, we know what we don't want to do. We understand we can do action, and this new gimmick for them, it was a gimmick. Ninja works. People buy it, you know, the buyers buy it. It was Franco Nero was the star of Enter the Ninja. Mm-hmm. And Shoka Sugi was the villain. And Mike Stone choreographed the fight. And suddenly it was, you know, the audiences around the world, not only here, suddenly they saw this novel new idea, ninja. It's a nice gimmick. It's a nice, has a nice look, the wardrobe.
Yeah, it was very, oh my God. When you're a kid. Yes.
This is the legend. This is the story. How Mike Stone, Menachem Golan, and how it was born.
Now, the funny thing is when you're a child, I mean, especially a kid growing up in the 80s, and you see a ninja for the first time, and you see the throwing star and the sword, and it's like, oh my, it was just a revelation. But I mean, nowadays there's so much. I mean, we, you know, nowadays they have 1,000 things, but back then there wasn't anything like that, especially not a thing on TV, no movies. It was a thing. And I think I think this is obvious. Cannon's explosion in the world marketplace had to do also with the timing of the home video market, which that they fed off of each other and exploded, correct?
Definitely. So remember, Canon eventually, when we are looking in hindsight, became the biggest of the independent company, companies, but it was not alone. There was a bunch of those companies, Shapiro Glickenhaus, AM Entertainment, Corelco, and many, many more. And all of them were producing, some of them specialized in horror only, some of them specialized in kind of comedies, some of them specialize in what they used to call TNA movies.
Right. So yeah, softcore,
so
erotica.
All those companies, there were many of them, and suddenly came in a new market, a new source of movie, which was the home video market, the rental. People went to the corner stores, they rented the movies. The major studios did not pay attention to this potential, right, to this money.
They were scared.
First. But those little companies, immediately they realized for them it was a gold mine, and they started to produce movies, and they sold it. So there was money. There was no problem. The risk was very low. So this was the beginning of the 80s. They took very low risk and worldwide, not only here in the North America, not only in the United States, Canada, but worldwide, this industry of renting cassettes to home was good. And, you know, the shops that had to buy those cassettes, they had to pay a lot of money.
Well, I worked at them. I worked at a video store. Oh, yeah, retail.
$120.
Oh, I think wholesale we used to pay 75 bucks for wholesale. Retail was $125.
At least 4 copies of every movie.
So. This is before Blockbuster bought 1,000 copies of everything and rent share.
It was a good business. So Canon thrived because of this money, because of this market, and they started to produce more and more movies to the point that at some years they made about 30 or 40 movies a year.
Jesus. And it's so funny too, because I remember I worked in the video store 88 to 92. So I was right in the middle of the heyday of video stores. There were no DVDs, any of that stuff. But I remember because I was the manager, we'd buy four copies of American Ninja.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Each one of those would make probably on return $400, $500 per. And then sometimes you would get a movie like Faces of Death, which give you $2,000 return because everybody wanted to rent that one. But it was true. Our store was full of the Orion Pictures and Canon and Carico. And then slowly the studios figured out. They're like, oh, maybe we should start throwing our movies up on there again.
It's exactly what happened. Eventually the major studios, they realized, they said, why are they making the money when we can make the money? We have the power. At the beginning of the 80s, the mindset of the studio was theater. Theatrical, you know, they make money in theaters, then they sell it to television, to networks, they make a little bit more money. Mm-hmm. They sell it to the airlines, they make a little bit more money with the airlines. But then they realize, they say, what's happening here? They're making good money over there with the cassette, with the home video. Let's move in. And then you had Predator, then you had True Lies.
Oh, God.
They decided, let's make those the same movies, a little bit bigger budget,
bigger stars,
better quality, and then we will we'll take over this industry.
Right. That's when the Die Hards and the Lethal Weapons and all of the – those were all essentially genre movies, but with
– genre with a better budget, with a bigger budget.
With bigger budgets, exactly. I look back on those days very fondly working, and everyone listening to the show knows how much I loved working in my video store. And I worked two video stores. I worked at a movie theater for 2 weeks and I quit because I hated cleaning up the popcorn. the video store was a much better gig.
but Alex, the studio is rigid. More or less. You know,
right.
There are so many departments. So when studio make a movie, it's rigid. The independent companies at the time, in the 80s, they went crazy because there was so much money. There were so many young directors.
Creator. Oh, yeah.
And basically they told the directors, you guys go and do whatever you want. We don't have time to control you and to bother you.
Right.
So Toby Hooper, Joe Zito, Sheldon, Ladish.
Yeah, you guys went. You
they
basically
all came
had
into the scene, and they started to make Friday the 13th, whatever, and eventually also
got picked up. Yeah, all
bigger
of those
movies came out of this bigger idea,
right? Like Texas Chainsaw Massacre and all these kind
Chainsaw
of stuff.
Chainsaw Massacre, because Terminator came out of this genre.
Yeah, exactly. With Jim Cameron, it was really a fun, interesting time because it was just those always the time when the studios are in trouble and they can't figure out or they have to fill a lot of content. They give a lot of freedom and creativity to the creators. It happened in the 70s with the Scorsese and the Spielbergs of the world, right? And Easy Rider. But in the 80s, there was so much need for content. I remember we used to be only able to buy 2 to 3 movies a week. That was all that was being released. Yeah. Like that was it. And then now, I mean, there's 3 movies a minute being released. And that was the other thing too, for people listening. And like you were saying that the studios were rigid. It took them 12 years before they opened up a streaming service after Netflix launched.
Same thing.
So Netflix made all the money for a decade, got a huge head start on them. And now they have a major competitor that they're losing talent to creativity. Actors are all losing them to Netflix because Netflix was ahead.
It really is. It's a tide that repeats itself. The only thing was really we were lucky. There was good money at the time in the 80s.
Oh.
I mean, it was not the budget. The movies that we made were not tremendous budget, but was not bad.
What are you talking about? Like a couple, 2-3 million in that time?
Yeah, because if you take American Ninja, for instance,
yeah,
we shot it 9 weeks, 6 day week, with 2 units, some
9 weeks, 3 units. 9 weeks, 9 weeks,
9 weeks of 6 day, 9 weeks of with 2 units, 2 full units.
That's unheard
of.
There
was one additional unit, so right. 2.5 full units. The crew was huge, like 250 people. We had anything we wanted. So they were really medium budget. And the streaming don't have this, you know, unless they make a event movie or television series, they don't give those budgets. And today, young filmmakers have to make movies in 5 weeks, 4 weeks.
5 days.
5 days, you're right.
It's remarkable. But, I mean, also back then, the barrier to entry was the technology. It was so expensive to own any of the technology to make it, where now it's not about technology. It's more, now it's about distribution. It's about actually getting your stuff seen. I always tell people in the 80s, if you finished a movie, good, bad, or indifferent, you made money with it. You sold it. It was sold. Yeah. If you shot a 35 millimeter movie, finished it, it went into the theaters. And then when the whole media market hit, it definitely went. I mean, I saw stuff that I'm like, how did this get produced?
So Golan has a very funny quote. I think in the movie Electric Boogaloo, the Secret of Canon, he said, and they quoted him, but it was a quote from the 80s. He said, If you make a movie and you don't make money, you're probably stupid. I don't understand how you cannot make money.
Well, but he had so his business model was low budget, you know, so we're talking, I mean, and $1 million to $3 million, which
right,
and above a little bit, depending on how big it was.
Even more, Electric Boogaloo was like $6 million.
Oh yeah, but you had a huge hit with Break-In, the first one, because
it was a circumstance.
And then, of course, he did Masters of the Universe, which was a whole other thing. That's a whole other conversation.
Another level of canon, which it's not exactly what we are talking about. Right,
sure,
now.
But that was I think that was their heyday.
But they had this model of, you know, They invented the so-called pre-sale. They used to create
really?
A lot of posters, took them to the marketplace, took them to their distributors, and offer them this poster, that poster, this idea, even before they had a script. If they saw that the buyer, you know, kind of liked it, here is a poster with Chuck Norris, you like it? They came back to the office, they pre-sold it, and then they came to the office, they rushly... In a rush way, they wrote a script and they went and made a movie to fulfill the promise of the poster.
And
the pre-sale concept.
So they came up with pre-sale.
They knew how much money to invest in the movie according to the pre-sales, to the amount of money.
So they're the ones that came up with pre-sales?
Yeah.
I had no idea that Canon was the guy. Those guys were the ones. Because when I heard about the pre-sales, I mean, pre-sales now are rare. But it does happen, especially if you have a relationship with the buyers and you're longstanding. But generally, because before you literally could go to AFM with a poster.
That's what they did.
Open up a shop and go, do you want this new movie with Michael Dudikoff in it? Great. $50,000 for your territory. $100,000 for your territory. $250,000 for Germany. And they would sell it up. So they came home. They're like, okay. We could invest, let's invest $1 million because we have $1.5 million in pre-sales. And then we also have other places we can make some more money off of it. I mean, it's a win-win.
Right. This was the model. This was the system. Beside the Menachem Golan and Yoram Globus, there was another partner, Danny Dimbord. He was the head of sales. And they kind of invented it. Everybody adapted the system, all the independent companies of pre-selling. But yes, there was so much need for product all over the world for this new emerging market of home video. You know, it was revolutionary. For young people today, it's hard to understand when you see the streaming. The idea that you can take a cassette, bring it home, start the movie, whatever you want, you can pause it, go to
rewind
the bathroom,
rewind it.
It was revolutionary. It's hard today. It's hard to grasp.
No,
revolutionary it was.
Right. I literally had to go see Ghostbusters 34 times in the theater when it came out as a kid. But when the VHS came out, I bought it, and I watched it 1 million times at home. And I would stop it. I would rewind it. I could play it back. I could play the scene I loved again. It was something that, you know, kids today really don't understand, because now they're like, well, I just open up my phone and everything that's ever been made is accessible to my fingertips. It was revolutionary, and people love that idea, and that you can go out and rent 2, 3, 4 movies a weekend or something like that.
And it was equal in Los Angeles
Yep.
And in some small village in Africa, same right. thing. Every right. little town in Africa in had the Far East had a little hat with a rented cassette.
The video hat. The video hat.
It's the machine, you know. So the village had a machine, or every home, and the machines were not expensive. It was a cheap.
It was amazing.
Product.
It was, and I try to explain to people too. Back and this, we're still only talking in the VHS days when DVD hit. It was cheaper to make things, then it was cheaper to produce the DVDs than it was to create the VHSs. You could make 1,000 of them in a minute, and it used to take a lot longer to do VHSs. And I told people, I'm like, that's why Sniper 7, 8, and 9 were pre-made and released, because they knew they were going to make $5 or $6 million in the DVD market. But then in 05, 06, it started to dwindle, and then streaming came along, and then it destroyed that market. And I think that everyone, I think it was basically from 1980 to early 2000s, it was a gold mine. Everybody was making money.
We call the type of movies that we are talking about, Friday the 13th, American Ninja, we are calling them the genre low budget independent movies of the 80s and the first half of the 90s.
Right.
So this was the era.
15 before, years.
And then the studios realized it was not the end of the this industry, but the studios started to take over in the middle of the 90s. And they started to come up with bigger budget, Predator, etc., True Lies,
Terminator 2, those things. Yeah.
They started to take over the market. Of course, they have more power, more financial power, better product, etc. Eventually, they took over and they created the relationship with Blockbuster,
and it became a
business of bigger budget movies.
Now,
pushed away the smaller companies.
Right, exactly. That's why Orion went under at that time, and Canon eventually.
All of them.
Everybody.
International.
My God, but they were making Carolco was making Terminator 2, Total Recall. You know, yes. Orion was doing RoboCop and won 4 or 5 Oscars in the course of a decade. I mean, it was.
And Carolco made some big movies.
Oh, huge movies they made. Yeah, absolutely. So American Fatal Ninja.
Attraction.
So American Ninja, which I just, you know, when I heard, first of all, the Ninja came out, and you did Revenge of the Ninja came out, and then the Ninjas started to come out. But then American Ninja, you're like, wait a minute, an American Ninja? And it was like a mind-blowing thing. You're like, holy cow, and Michael Dudikoff is up there, and he's doing, how did American Ninja come out? Was that your idea? How did that come?
Not my idea. So they made Enter the Ninja. Let's just talk a little bit about the history of the Ninja. The company made Enter the Ninja, and the movie did pretty well, you know, moderately well. And they immediately wanted a sequel. They wanted to make Revenge of the Ninja. They liked Sho Kasugi very much. He was the villain in Enter the Ninja. But Menachem Golan, which directed Enter the Ninja, did not want, you know, the company was starting to take off and he was busy. He didn't want to do the sequel. So he turned to me. I just finished directing a movie that I sold to Canon. This was the beginning of Canon, 1982. Mm-hmm. I just sold to them a movie, One More Chance, that I directed and produced. And they turned to me and said, would you direct this? Of course, we had relationship. As I told you, I was his assistant director. I was assistant director in the company for a while. And here they saw that I can make a movie. This was One More Chance movie with Kirstie Alley, by the way. The first movie that she did, Kirstie Alley. And they turned to me and said, would you direct the sequel? Okay, so we made Revenge of the Ninja with Sho Kasugi. He was the star. It was, they liked it. It was kind of successful. They wanted, for them, it was more than successful. It was the first movie that MGM picked up. It was the first movie from Canon that a major company picked up for distribution, Revenge of the Ninja, because it was distributed by MGM.
Okay.
Theatrically.
I remember the box. I remember the VHS box was the big
with Sho Kasugi flying in the sky with the red
sky. Yeah.
And this was actually designed by MGM.
Mm-hmm.
And now we are talking, you know, they really need a sequel because they make money. So, you know, because of some reason, Sho Kasugi did not feature. He was in the third, the Ninja 3, the Domination. He was not the feature character, but Lucinda Dickey. It was a female ninja. And then suddenly there was the craze of breakdance. So Cannon posed with ninjas, and they did Breaking and Breaking 2 Electric Boogaloo, which I directed. Again, a sequel. Mm-hmm. But the interest of the, when I say the interest of the buyers around the world, maybe the viewers with the breakdance, with the breaking,
was quick.
Favored off quickly, and the buyers wanted more ninja. They want ninjas. Mm-hmm. By now, everybody's making ninja movies. And they call me back to the office. Menachem Golan calls me to a meeting, and he says, we need another ninja movie, but this time it's going to be American Ninja. So not my idea. The phrase came from him. I don't know how he came up with this idea. Now, this is a revolution, actually a revolutionary and crazy, really crazy idea. Because ninja is really unique. We already mentioned it's
Japan.
It's very unique to Japanese culture. You can have a Brazilian martial art, but you don't have a Brazilian ninja.
Right.
Capoeira, which is a Brazilian martial art. There is a Chinese martial art. There is Korean martial art, but not ninja. Ninja is specifically Japanese.
It's like samurai.
Part of the Japanese mythology. And,
of course.
And as long as we made the ninja, the first three ninja movies with some connection to Japanese culture, it was fine. Okay, but here he comes with the idea, forget about the Japanese. Forget about them. We're going to make American ninja, no connection to Japan whatsoever, to Japan culture. So it was his idea. There was no script. There was no nothing. This was only this idea. And, I was thrilled. I like American cinema. I believe that American cinema is the most successful. And this is as close as I will get to a James Bond. To directing
right.
James Bond. Or directing a Western, American Ninja. So now I'm in the... I'm about to do a Western or James Bond.
So American Ninja did extremely well. It blew. It exploded, didn't it? It killed at the video stores. I mean, just killed.
We didn't know what's going to happen. You know, of course, as I said, for Canon, Breaking was a major, major moneymaker. The first Breaking and Breaking 2 Electric Boogaloo were big.
Massive. You're talking about tens of millions of dollars. Breaking was huge.
And both of them were, MGM. The first Breaking was distributed by MGM. The second, the one I directed, was distributed by Columbia TriStar.
Right.
So big distribution.
So Canon at this point is getting major distribution from, because I know they had an output deal with Warner Brothers. That's how they got.
Bloodsport. You mentioned Master of the Universe. They were flirting a little bit with the. Superman.
Yeah, oh god, yeah, that's right. They did that canon Superman.
By then, they also already had the Chuck Norris on a contract. Uh-huh. Invasion USA, Missing in Action. So they already had Chuck Norris working for them, and they had Charles Bronson working for them exclusively at this point. Death Wish number 2, Death Wish number 3, Death Wish number 4. So by then the company was big, and they sent us to the Philippines to make it, to Manila, to make American Ninja. And, you know, we chose Michael Dudikoff to be the American Ninja, the persona, the actor who will personify American Ninja. And we are there, and we start to make the movie, and we kind of realize, you never know, while making a movie, nobody knows if the movie will be a success, will not be a success, the audience will like it, will hate it. You don't know. You're making, it's enigmatic. Big question mark when you make a movie. But there was a good feeling. We saw Michael on the screen, the charisma, the relationship between Michael Dudikoff and Steve James. It was really, the bond was working on the screen. Even the love story, Michael Dudikoff with Judy Aronson, and she came from Friday the 13th. So this was working well. And we put the movie together, editing room and music. And actually, they were so eager to continue the company that they sent us to before the movie was released, they sent us to New Orleans with Michael Dudikoff and Steve James and myself to make the movie Avenging Force, which was really meant for Chuck Norris, and he didn't want to do it. It was part of the Invasion USA franchise. But he didn't want to. So we are now in New Orleans shooting this movie, filming this movie, Avenging Force. And then the American Ninja came out in theaters. And then we hear, we kind of start to hear and read the explosion worldwide. I'm not talking about America.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
That this is like the new Tarzan, or this is the new mini James Bond.
Right.
Not this big, yeah, but wow, this whole idea, the concept, the phrase American Ninja, and it's exploding all over the world. And we are there in New Orleans. The two actors did not even participate in any promotion, anything, because we were
busy. Yeah, it was just like do your thing. Yeah, you just really
said. It was huge immediately. Of course, there is a target audience. You were the target audience.
Sure.
The young people, male, boys, teenager, or up to the age 35, 40, this was the mainly. Then, of course, there were also girls that like this. He was so handsome. Michael was so handsome. He looked so good. But it was a target market. It hit the market right on all over the world.
What year was that?
1985.
Right. So right when, God, the video stores are exploding. I remember my first video store experience was 81, 82. And I rented, I think, no, it was actually later than that, probably like 84. But I rented Flashdance. I never forgot it. Never forgot it. And we rented Flashdance. So around that time, it was starting to really take off. Blockbuster's still years away. So the mom and pop stores are still running everything.
And in the case of American Ninja, it was theatrical all over the world, not only video.
Yeah.
It played theatrically in Africa, in Asia, or in South America, all over the world. Suddenly it was, if before there was some kind of the audience, I'm trying to theorize here, the audience has to relate to Japanese type of a culture. Now, from this moment on, they didn't have to. It was a James Bond, American Ninja, it was Hollywood movie, the way they like, the way most of the action movies in the world look like. And all American characters, it was a military, in a military base, American military base, the story happened. So I guess it was easy for the audiences around the world, the young people, to identify and this character.
Yeah, no question. And what I also always loved, I absolutely loved the chemistry between Michael and Steve. James, I mean, the late, great Steve James. He was so charismatic on camera. I just never forgot him. I looked him up a few years ago and heard that he had passed, and I was very saddened by it because I was looking, I'm like, maybe I could use him. I would love to have him in one of my movies just to, to show respect to a hero of mine when I was a child. His chemistry was amazing. Was all that, like a lot of those lines in that stuff on set, was that him and Michael just kind of, riffing?
So, yes, you're right. When we were in the casting of American Ninja, and our main goal was to find this character, American Ninja, Joe Armstrong, but also Jackson was already written in the script. His buddy, his sidekick, was written in the script. And we saw a lot of young people for both parts. But we had some hesitation with American Ninja, with Joe Armstrong, because everything is on his shoulder. But let me tell you, when Steve James walked in for the casting, and I spoke with him a little bit, and he was a martial artist, and we read a few lines, we didn't look anymore, and he agreed. When he agreed to do it, we didn't look anymore for this Jackson character. This was Steve James. He was, he walked in, he was huge, big muscles, the shoulders, the way he looked like a Hercules.
And he was funny. He was funny. Hercules. He was smart and funny. He was smart and funny too.
So he had this, what you see eventually on the screen. And when we got to the Philippines, they didn't have even chance to meet each other, Michael Dudikoff and Steve James, up to the point, because in the low budget, we don't have rehearsals. We don't have money for rehearsals. And they don't give us any rehearsal time. So the first time you meet your fellow actor or the director, many times with the actor, it's on the set the first time, the first day of shooting. So they met on the set and they started the... You know, as the scenes were developing, I don't remember exactly the order that we were shooting the scenes, but the chemistry between them were developing on and on. Now, Steve was a big fan of action movies, and almost I would say a historian of action movies, especially black action movies. You know, he had a big collection at home, Steve, like 2,000 movies. He was specializing in black cinema, even from the either black directors, black actors, from the silent era. Wow. He was collecting movies. But anyway, he was, so this genre Shaft, you know, he wanted to be the new Shaft, Steve, basically.
He could have been.
This genre was very familiar to him. So back to your question, many of the one-liners, many of the mannerism he brought in. But now let me tell you something funny. Anecdote. Every time, you know, I made few movies with Steve James. I directed a few times. But then at some point, he knew exactly in the script, at some point he tears off his shirt, throws it away. So and to show his muscles. So I said, Steve, you're not asking me. Every time in every movie, at some point you take off your shirt and you continue. He said, what do you think? You know how hard I'm working for those muscles? All this hard work, I'm not going to show it off. I have to show it off. I have to show off.
So then how many American ninjas were there? I think I remember it up to four. Was there more?
Yeah, yeah. I directed only two of them.
Okay.
And then I directed with Michael and Steve the movie Avenging Force. Mm-hmm. And I directed with Steve James another movie which was completely different movie, which was called Riverbend. Mm-hmm. And this is not in the genre of the ninja, not even martial art. It's kind of it's a racial tension movie in the South in the 60s.
Oh, that must have been awesome.
It's a very, and he was the lead. He was very happy. But even then, there was a little fight. He took off his shirt.
Of course, well, obviously. Listen, if I looked like Steve James, I would walk around without my shirt all the time.
I had the privilege to direct Steve James four times, four movies.
Like I said, if I looked like Steve James, I would walk around without a shirt all the time. I mean, absolutely. There would be no question. Anyone listening, Google Steve James and you'll understand what I mean. Now, was the biggest hit for Canon American Ninja, or was it Break-In?
No, I don't know exactly by number. Let's say they produced about 200, 300 movies.
Jesus.
The best, let's say the best from a quality point of view, the best movie was Runaway Train.
Oh, yeah.
Most of people agree that it's the best movie they made was Runaway Train with Eric Roberts and John Voight. But in popularity, they had few kind of franchises that were doing very well. The American Ninja, the Death Wish, and the Missing in Action with Chuck Norris. Mm-hmm. So one franchise was Charles Bronson, which was doing very well. One franchise was Chuck Norris, which was doing terrific. And the third one was American Ninja. Now, when the company ended up with bankruptcy and a lot of companies and people and creditors came to the court, because they probably owed money to everybody, to a lot of places. And the assets were divided. Everybody wanted American Ninja. It's a good title. And eventually MGM won the entire American Ninja series. And the Breakdance series went to MGM. So all the movies that I directed for Canon ended up with MGM. But some movies ended up with Warner Brothers, some ended up with Paramount and other creditor. Charles Bronson was a creditor. He
was owed
him a lot of money.
Jesus.
yes, but this was as a title, American Ninja is the title
IP, American the IP,
the best thing that Canon had as an asset. not necessarily the movies, but as a title, as a
VIP.
Because Missing in Action doesn't sound, it sounds good, but it's okay. Or Death Wish, they did not originate, as you know, Death Wish was originated before Canon.
Right, exactly. So then you did, so I remember when Break-In came out, because I was breakdancing as a kid back then, and Break-In was one, it was Break-In and Beat Street. Those were the two big breakdancing movies that came out that those years. Then came out Break-In 2, The Electric Boogaloo, which I argue is probably the best title for a sequel ever. It is Electric Boogaloo. Anytime you're trying to make a joke, I'm like, oh yeah, we're going to make Lethal Weapon 3, The Electric Boogaloo. Like, you always throw Electric Boogaloo at the end of it. Who came up with Electric Boogaloo?
Okay, the phrase Electric Boogaloo, there is a lot of discussion and a lot of disagreement and about this. Now, there is an essay. Somebody wrote an essay about this phrase, Electric Boogaloo, with the really research into history of where it comes. Now, our two stars, Shabadoo, also the late, poor Shabadoo, also passed away this year. Oh. Shabadoo and Michael Shrimps, both of them kind of claim that they have invented it. But it has a deep root way back in the 50s, from what I read in the article. So either there was a Boogaloo was a type of a dancing that goes all the way back to the 50s and to the 60s. And Shabadoo was very active in the television show, The Train, the Soul Train.
Yeah.
And in the Soul Train, there were a lot of Boogaloo, that there is a style of dancing that goes way back. How it was kind of
combined.
And the shrimp, and the name of the street name of Michael Chambers. So he's Michael Boogaloo Shrimp. Mm-hmm. Chambers, Michael Boogaloo Chambers. So Jeez. He kind of attached this, the word Boogaloo to his name. But the combination of those two words, Electric Boogaloo, happened after the movie Break-In. And so it's probably in this, because they already knew that they want to make a sequel.
Who did it though? But who actually put it together for the movie?
It was between Menachem Golan, Shabadoo. I had nothing to do with it. When I was hired, when I was asked to do the movie, to direct it, the name Breaking 2 Electric Boogaloo was already on the script. So I have nothing to do with it. So every one of them, in many discussions, if you search the internet for interviews with the Shabadoo, interviews with the Shrimp, with Michael Chandler, or written interviews, you will find many different versions. But to the best of my knowledge, the legend, it happened in the Cannes Film Festival. When they were selling Break-In, they took the three of them, Lucinda and Shabadoo and Michael, took with them to Cannes to promote the movie. And as they saw that the response of the buyer, they immediately decided to do a sequel. And the legend, the story tells that right there in Cannes, it came together, this Break-In 2, Electric Boogaloo.
I still remember.
Now you're right about that. It became a meme of the 80s, a phrase of the 80s, and it was borrowed to many, many different purposes, including at some point somebody put a joke: we should write a Bible to Electric Boogaloo. But lately, it took a sinister turn. You know, it was adapted by the group, the Boogaloos.
That's right,
white supremacy group.
Right, right.
They believe in a sequel of the Civil War.
Of course,
They took the word. The beginning, they used to call it the Second Civil War Electric Boogaloo, but then it was shortened to the Boogaloos. The believers in a second civil war.
Oh my God! I know.
So it's the whole gamut, you know, from dancing to comedy to this to a sinister
right wing
supremacy.
And you know, and it's interesting also because as artists, you just put things out there and you don't know how it's going to be received and who's going to take what, and you just don't know as a creator of these things, but. You know, I like to look at it, that term Electric Boogaloo is a very funny, a joke that a lot of people kind of throw on, like the Bible to Electric Boogaloo and things like that, that it's just so, it's just one of those names that you hear it, you never forget it. You hear Break Into, like you never forget it.
Right, it has a good ring to it, it has a good sound. And, you know, when they made the the sequel when they made the documentary about Kenon.
Right.
So immediately they took the title of the movie of the documentary is Electric Boogaloo.
Which summarizes everything Cannon did in two words. It's remarkable. Now I do remember, I never forgot this scene. And I know how you do it, but I'd love to find out how you guys did it. How did Turbo dance on the ceiling? You know, when he was dancing up on the wall, I know it's generally a big giant thing. I've seen Chris Nolan do it. I've seen Stanley Kubrick do it, but generally you don't have those kind of budgets. So how the heck did you guys do it?
Okay. So, this was not on the original script. This dance was not on the original script. And one day, even while I was shooting, we were shooting the movie in East LA, in the neighborhood, which is called Boyle's Heights, mm-hmm. which was the scene, the center of hip hop and breakdancing. I was called lunchtime, and I was called back to the office. The offices were in Hollywood. And Menachem Golan said, come back. I had no idea why I'm coming back. Maybe he wants to fire me. Maybe I don't know. But anyway, he had this idea. He said, let's have a shrimp dancing in the ceiling. Now, this is not a new idea. It was done by Fred Astaire.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Royal Wedding, the name of the movie. So that's the first time it was done. Then it was used in Kubrick, Friday the 13th, many horror pictures. And mm-hmm. So basically, I knew what it is. It's a... The mechanism is called gimbal. Gimbal is kind of a simulator for flight simulator. You have there are aerial photographers. So they practice in this gimbal. They put them on a seat and then it's a two big, huge hoops or rings, big one on rollers, and the chair is in the center. And then you can roll those big, so the cinematographer is upside down, or the pilot in training is upside down. Now, if you take this huge, huge gimbal, this huge, big rings, the two rings on rollers, and the set, the room is built inside. The camera is glued to the floor of the set, or kind of hooked, not glued necessarily. braced, and if you turn the room around, the camera does not see the turning around because the camera goes around with the room. So for the cameraman, the room is always the same.
Straight.
Looks straight. But a dancer, you know, once you're 90 degrees, let's say the cameraman is to the right or to the left, the dancer is already on the wall, but the wall is horizontal to earth. Mm-hmm. And when it is all the way up,
it's upside down.
180 degrees, the cameraman is up, all the way up, and the ceiling now is down, and he's dancing in the ceiling. But the camera doesn't see the difference. What you do need, everything has to be glued to the set. So all the pictures on the wall,
everything,
all the books on the shelf, like behind you, you have books mm-hmm. on the shelf, they have to be glued. Because when it's upside down, you don't want all the book to
fall in.
And if there is some scenery in the window, the scenery has to move in the window with the gimbal. And all the lighting, you cannot have a change of light. So the lighting, everything moves together with this rotating.
And
that's how it's done. And, you know, it was done in a lot in horror pictures. I think that we got our particular gimbal from Elm Street.
I was going to say Wes Craven, because I know he did it for the blood coming out of the bed.
Okay,
so
it was somewhere around in a warehouse in Hollywood, and
they rented it. Okay, that makes sense.
Set was built. Our department built the set.
Sure.
And we hired a special cinematographer. You need an aerial cinematographer because when they're upside down, not to get confused, they are the aerial photo cinematographers. They are used to this turning around, upside down, and etc.
I have to ask you. Thank you for that, because I mean I always wonder, like, they didn't have $10 million to build something like this, but I didn't think that they just had a couple of these lying around in LA, because in LA there's everything. I shot a television series.
Our operation was so cheap that it was turned by hand. We didn't have motors.
Some grips.
The grips just kept pulling on this huge ring, and by hand, you know, manually. No, I mean, the room.
For people always ask, like, should I move to LA? I'm like, look, you know, I just moved away from LA. I love LA, but in LA, there's a standing spaceship set that I shot a whole series on. It's just a standing set that looks like aliens. It's there. You can't find that in Ohio.
You know, naturally, the industry, you know, you have to deal with cars, you go to Detroit. I mean, it's natural.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
I worked all over the world. I worked and filmed all over the world. And there is, from a convenient point of view, from a technical point of view, and from personnel, from people point of view, expertise, there is no place in the world like Hollywood for making film. I'm not talking maybe Hong Kong, of course, in Hong Kong and China, mm-hmm. but London, but mm-hmm. there is nothing like Hollywood. You have a generator goes down, within 10 minutes, you have another generator on the set immediately.
Easily.
Somebody will find another generator in 10 minutes and it will be on the set and working. You need this special lens, crazy lens.
Done.
Somewhere it is, somewhere for rent.
Within 5 or 10 minute drive.
Props, yeah. Set, wardrobe. Obviously, this is the center of this industry.
It's
the central point in the world for Western movie making is Hollywood.
Absolutely.
So everything is here. You're right.
Now, what is the craziest story that you can say publicly from your times in canon?
The truth is, nothing extraordinary happened on any of the sets that I work. Not a serious injury, obviously nothing, you know, fatal, nothing happened. Not a serious. We were so careful and so methodic in working, and nothing crazy happened while filmmaking. But let me tell you an interesting story that relates and does not relate. We were in the Philippines, in Manila, shooting American Ninja. And we stayed in a nice hotel, Manila Hotel, in Manila. This was the biggest hotel, most beautiful. And Sunday, we were not shooting, we were not working. We are in the swimming pool. Most of the time, we were in the swimming pool. So one of those Sundays, the crew is in the swimming pool, and next to me, Michael Dudikoff. And we are kind of laying on those chairs in the sun and enjoying. And Michael is next to me. I'm here. Michael is next to me. Suddenly, I realize that something is wrong. There is a woman frantically running on the edge of the pool. And I look down and I see a girl. That what seems like a girl that like still like going up and down. She's drowning. And I look up and there was a lifeguard, but he was completely busy. His attention was completely in another direction.
Jesus.
So I hit Michael right away. Michael was right next to me. Hey, Michael, jump with me into the pool. No question. So we both jump into the pool and we dove all the way by then the girl was all the way in the water. And what we could see her. So, and nobody sees, only this woman, which apparently was the mother, and nobody else. It was just a moment that nobody was paying attention to what's happening in the water. And Michael and me were diving all the way down to the bottom. We grab the girl, we bring there, both of us, put her on the edge. By then, she's not breathing anymore.
Okay.
So I'm trying or whatever, crew, to do whatever we do. But, you know, I'm not a medic. I don't know what I'm doing. And pushing and breath, resuscitation. But then comes a young man. He says, I'm a soldier. I'm a medic. Move over, everybody. Let me. I'm the only one in charge here right now. He was one of the soldiers, the American soldiers. At the time, there were many, many American soldiers in the Philippines. He took over. He knew what he was doing much better than us. Resuscitation, push the on the chest. Water came out. Boom, she came back. And that's it. The girl came back to life, let's say. And, you know, we visited her. And it was very exciting, very emotional, you know, to bring somebody from the dead back to life. She was, her family was actually Chinese from Hong Kong. They were visiting and vacationing over there. And later on, I was in Hong Kong and I visited with the family. But there are a nice picture of Michael and me with the girl a day later, you know, with this girl. And I consider it pretty crazy for that we were there shooting American Ninja at the right moment in the hotel. In the right
on the day off,
and, yeah. To save somebody's life. So I consider it maybe the purpose of the movie American Ninja was actually to save a girl.
Right. So American Ninja actually saved the American Ninja actually saved her.
Absolutely.
Now let me ask you.
They didn't have when we went to South Africa. Mm-hmm. We were talking about the explosion of American Ninja. And then we were shooting a Night Hunter, which became Avenging Force in New Orleans, all of us. And as we came back and we finished the editing, they needed a sequel to American Ninja badly, because American Ninja was a huge hit all over the world. And they needed badly. And for some reason, they had some money in South Africa. So apartheid, South Africa, it was toward the end of apartheid, but still apartheid. And Steve was pretty worried. He said, well, I'm a black person. I'm going now to South Africa. What's it? But he told me, anyway, you're going ahead of me, you know, pre-production. Call me, and I want to hear from you every day. Call me every day. Tell me what it is in South Africa. Nobody knows. Mm-hmm. We went to South Africa, and this was really the ending days of the apartheid. Actually, when I was there, there used to be three different identification cards, different IDs for different races. But by then, they unified it to one card. There were no more different cards with different colors. So I called Steve. I spoke with Steve a few times. And then, Steve, nothing to worry about. It's changing. The atmosphere is really changing. There is no more white beach, black beach. It's changing, you know, really changing. Come over. So he came over, and the first week, and in the weekend, we went out in Johannesburg to the street. Now, we didn't realize how big they became. Michael Dudikoff and Steve James became huge stars to the kids. Mm-hmm. They were recognized everywhere. We couldn't walk in the street anymore.
Wow.
Because all the young African kids were running after them, especially Steve, that was tall and impressive and you know, probably for them, they saw this
hero,
black hero, not only, you know, the African-American hero. For them, it was something special. And they ran with everywhere we went with Steve James. It was impossible in the streets of Johannesburg.
Wow. God, that's amazing. Well, let me ask you. So I'm going to ask you a few questions to ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to make it in today's business?
What I see today, let's say action, more action, because, you know, there are always place for drama, personal movies you can always make. And as you mentioned, technology is cheap. All you need is a computer, camera, put the editing program in your computer, and you can make a movie. So all those personal movie like Moonlight, those movies will always be done. Young people who wants to tell story and express themselves, they will do it. The question comes now when you want to make a more expensive movie. When you want to make an action movie, it's not cheap. Making action movie is not cheap. And there are explosions, there are mechanical, there are cars, chases, etc., etc. And what happened from a business point of view, that the movies went through transformation in the 2000, etc., they became paperback movies. It was expensive to make movie. You needed a lab, you needed a camera, you needed to buy film, you needed to print the film. Everything was expensive. So you couldn't make a very, very, very cheap movie. And you couldn't make movie, you needed at least to be near a lab to develop the film, at least. And this have changed a lot. It's cheap now, you don't need the lab. So the cost of production has shrunk. The buyer, the potential buyer, television stations, streaming services, whoever, buy those small independent movies, they got used. Now they can pay less money to buy the movies. You don't. So now they used to buy a movie for $1 million. A young filmmaker that just finished the movie, you can have my movie for $80,000. I don't need $1 million. I will cover my cost if I sell it to you, $80,000, and I sell it to some German television, etc. Very quickly, I will cover my cost. So the buyer got used to buy cheap movies. Now, when it comes to make an action movie, and you need this 8 weeks or 9 weeks of shooting, and you need the $6 million today, equivalent, $4 million, the buyers say, don't make this action movie. I don't care. If you are not making Spider-Man, if you are not making a superhero, huge event movie, don't make this movie. I will buy the small movie, the cheap horror movie. I will buy the cheap dramas. So the sources have dried. The money have dried to make an action movie. And despite the fact that it's cheaper, technologically cheaper, but still you need the money. And there is no money around. So producers who want a young director to do action movies, they're asking them to do it for $1 million today money, 4 weeks shooting, and it's not really action movie. So this is a tough area when you deal with action or sci-fi, stuff that needs special effect. This is one area. The saving grace is the digital effects. Graphic digital effect. We did not have it. We had to, or they were very, very, very expensive. So we had to physically produce everything. Every fight, every chase, every car.
Blood hit. Had
to really physically be done. We had to flip cars. Today, with some ingenuity and some knowledge, you can flip a car in your computer. You don't have to flip the car anymore. Can have a huge explosion for no money. Etc. So those two forces, which are really working against each other or complementing each other, less money, much less money, but the technology of the CGI, of the computerized graphic special effect help. So they have to navigate this area. They also, the young filmmakers, again, in action, they come up from a different background. We came from a background of, as I say, Western, James Bond, Tarzans, and the young filmmakers are coming from the background of video games.
Sure.
Not from movies. Their visual background, the visual way they see things is the way they saw it when they play video games when they were kids.
Right.
Fast pace, great special effect, very grand stuff. So. Those are the things that have changed, but you can prove yourself by having a computer and a camera.
Fair enough.
Few young people can buy a camera, they can buy a supercomputer.
Or they can just buy, or this.
Right now, the phone.
The phone will do it. Then it shoots 5K or 8K now. Who knows? It's insane.
Right.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
I don't know the longest, but in the movie, if you take the movie business as an analogy to life, you know.
Okay. Right? Okay.
I would say as a director. Director is the chief guy. He's the top of the pyramid. He makes the decision, and he delegates the tasks to everybody, so he's at the top of the pyramid. So I've learned, I think the most important is really you have to be humble. You have to humble yourself. There is nothing you do by yourself. This is the biggest bluff in the world. Unless you're an animator and you sit at home for 3 years by yourself and you make a movie animation, you use a lot of talent. The director, the creator of any, this type of movie. It's not painting. You're not in your studio by yourself painting. You need a lot of help and a lot of talent, and only with the help, only with the harnessing all those different talents into your talent as the director, as the storyteller, the magic will happen. So in my case, my success, the movies that have been successful, American Ninja, Electric Boogaloo, they happened because many people contributed to it, the performers, the art director, the art, the cinematographer, and all of this together was channeled through my talent or my abilities or whatever you want to call it, to create what you've created. And I think it's also true in life. You don't go alone by yourself. You're not a loner. I can tell it now. I'm 70 years old and look back. You don't go alone by yourself if you don't have a support by friends and family, etc.
Very true.
That's probably it.
Now, and what are three of your favorite films of all time?
Films of all time?
Three.
I'll tell you. Of all, it's hard to say. There are so many films.
Just three that come to mind.
But I love Akira Kurosawa's movies. When I was introduced to this Japanese genre of action, Yojimbo, Seven Samurai, I was struck in awe. You know, like, wow.
It's amazing.
But, you know, I was influenced a lot when I was young by Hitchcock movies, you know, watching John Ford and etc. I'm not a great fan of horror pictures. So those are the type of movies. Let's say the most impressive are the movies of David Lean.
Oh, I mean,
Dr. Zhivago, Lawrence of Arabia. Big, vast movies.
Giant.
Big movies. And those are really the movies that I really like. There is a big vastness to it. Some action, great
drama,
human
character,
drama unfold within the movie, the story of the movie, etc.
There's very few directors in today's world that gets to play on that kind of canvas. You know, the James Camerons, the Steven Spielbergs, the Chris Nolans of the world. They get to play in these giant canvases because it's so darn expensive to play on those canvases, but it's remarkable. But Sam, listen, I want to thank you for coming on the show. It has been an absolute honor and pleasure talking to you and going back down the nostalgia lane, talking about Canon and your amazing work you did back in the 80s and 90s. I appreciate you, my friend, and thank you for helping make my childhood a little bit more interesting and entertaining. So I appreciate you, my friend.
Yeah, well, first of all, you're very welcome, and I was happy to be and talk with you, and I hope that the listeners will enjoy what we talked about.
I want to thank Sam so much for coming on the show and sharing his journey with the tribe. It was a treat. Now, if you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/545. And don't forget to check out our new private community, IFH Pro. Head over to indiefilmhustle.com/pro and check out what we got going on there. Thank you again so much, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's INDIEFILMHUSTLE.com.